Latter-day Saints are expelled from Jackson County, Missouri by the time this all plays out, and it's over the accusation that Latter-day Saints are too inclusive. Yeah.
Oh my God.
And we feel like when you read it and we see portrayals of it, we feel like, or we get the, I personally, I'll speak for myself, get that it was just all because they wanted to practice their faith. Like, we don't get to see and understand, like, the actual background of these things that's actually happened. So this is definitely eye-opening.
Well, it's two sections of the Missouri State Code right there in his article. If you come to Jackson County, you have to have papers that substantiate your status as a free black person who are subject to being whipped and expelled from the state. And I don't want that to happen to my fellow Latter-day Saints. So he says, let prudence guide. Mm-hmm. That's enough. Missouri outsiders, when they read Phelps's article, they say, okay, Mormons are inviting free black people. They're going to incite a slave rebellion, and they're going to steal our white wives and daughters.
The views expressed in this podcast are the opinions of the hosts and do not represent The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or the membership at large. Thank you for watching. We'll see you in the foyer.
Really everyone who would hear to come. So there's a gratefulness about that, and that its foundation, we were all included.
Yes.
So there's, thank you so much for that confirmation and clarity, because knowing that, I think, really helps a lot of members around the world to just know that at its roots, we were not only meant to be here, we were here.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
The first documented of Black Latter-day Saint is 1830 in Kirtland, Ohio, and there have been Black Latter-day Saints ever since, mm-hmm. right? But just to emphasize your point, right? So before I started writing this, I read the Doctrine and Covenants with a racial lens, right? And I would challenge your listeners to do this, because it emphasized to me so the openness of those revelations, right? So I hadn't recognized this before, and I've been reading the Doctrine and Covenants my whole life, right? But five revelations that say the gospel is to be preached unto every creature. Mm-hmm. We love to say every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. Every creature leaves no room, no wiggle room, right?
Yeah.
Who does that leave out? No one.
Never.
The intent is for every creature to be introduced to the gospel message. And early Latter-day Saint missionaries took that seriously. I mean, that's what the evidence demonstrates, right? They're baptizing free black people, enslaved black people, and white enslavers. Mm-hmm. Like, every creature includes all of those people who are a part of this, mix in the antebellum period in the United States. And then Joseph Smith, claims a revelation in which Jesus is speaking in first-person voice in 1831, all flesh is mine, and I am no respecter of persons.
Mm. Wow.
What color of flesh does Jesus not claim as his own, right?
Mm.
But I've read those scriptures before until you sort of recognize and read them racially, right? Like, this inclusive language is just embedded in the scriptures of the Restoration.
Yes.
And I'm not denying, the challenges of the racial passages in the Book of Mormon. I'm not suggesting those don't exist. And obviously the Book of Abraham, I addressed that here, but nonetheless, the revelations of the Restoration are inclusive.
I love that.
Yeah.
Is it safe to say that some of the persecutions that the church had at that time was because of the inclusion of, black people and how they integrated? And just, is it safe to say that some of that persecution arose because of that?
100%. Yeah. So, 1833, Missouri, right? So Joseph Smith has defined Jackson County, Missouri as Zion, as the gathering place. And W.W. Phelps is the editor of the Evening and Morning Star newspaper, a Latter-day Saint newspaper in Jackson County. And he writes an article called Free People of Color in the Evening and Morning Star. And he says, okay, to my fellow Black Latter-day Saints, Zion has now been defined as is located in a slave state. We have no special rule in this church as to people of color, he says. Okay, so once again, if you want to suggest that the racial restrictions are in place from the beginning, you have to argue against the evidence. We have no special rule in the church as to people of color, but the state of Missouri does. to my fellow Black Latter-day Saints, if you're going to gather to Zion, you need to be aware of Missouri state code that prohibits your ability to move freely in this state. If you come to Jackson County, he quotes two sections of the Missouri state code right there in his article. If you come to Jackson County, you have to have papers that substantiate your status as a free Black person, or you are subject to being whipped and expelled from the state. And I don't want that to happen to my fellow Latter-day Saints. So he says, let prudence guide. That's enough for outsiders in Missouri to form a vigilance committee. They say Mormons are inviting free Blacks to the state of Missouri to incite a slave rebellion. So some slave states basically say you can't free, you can't, if you are a white enslaver, you can't individually manumit your slaves without permission from even the legislature in some states. Right? Yeah. And if you're a free Black, some states write laws that say you have to leave the state within a certain amount of time, right? And for Missouri, you have to have papers that substantiate your status as a free Black. But remember, Nat Turner's rebellion has just happened.
Yeah.
There's fear around the slaveholding states that Black enslaved people are going to rebel, right? And so Missouri outsiders, when they read Phelps's article, they say, okay, Mormons are inviting free Black people, they're going to incite a slave rebellion, and they're going to steal our white wives and daughters, projecting fear of race mixing onto the Latter-day Saints almost from the beginning.
Wow, that gives so much more context.
It does.
Yeah.
Whoa. I think I know about 50% of that.
But like the rebellion that happened, that gives a lot of context to why people were so much on edge. Yeah. That shows why their mindset was there anyway, and it just progressed further.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
I mean, so newspaper articles is what I looked at, right? How are Latter-day Saints sort of being described by outsiders? So they have created an asylum for rogues and vagabonds and free Blacks. They're promoting Black ascendancy over the whites. So these are accusations that are being leveled against Latter-day Saints in Missouri. And by the time this all plays out in 1833, right, they attack Phelps's printing office. They he writes an extra. He tries to calm people down. He says, oh, I didn't really mean that. And in fact, Black people aren't, accepted. So when pressure comes, right, white Latter-day Saints are going to once again fold. Yeah. He writes an extra, tries to calm people down. They storm his printing office, destroy the extra, destroy the original article that he wrote, scatter his type into the street, and haul two Latter-day Saints into the town square and tar and feather them, which is a 19th century ritual of violence that basically marks you as outsiders, and this is a warning, you need to leave. And that's the beginning of the Latter-day Saint expulsion from Jackson County. So 1,200 Latter-day Saints are expelled from Jackson County, Missouri by the time this all plays out, and it's over the accusation that Latter-day Saints are too inclusive. Yeah.
My God.
And we feel like when you read it and we see portrayals of it, we feel like, or we get the, I personally, I'll speak for myself, get that it was just all because they wanted to practice their faith. Like, we don't get to see and understand, like, the actual background of these things that's actually happened. So this is definitely eye-opening.
Yeah, I think adding the racial lens to that, right? It's not that they're not being denigrated as racially different, but how do you justify an extermination order against people who look like you?
Yeah.
You suggest that they're not, in fact, like you. So I look at the Hans Mill Massacre. So this is, you know, by 1838, then Mormons are being expelled from the state altogether, right, under threat of state-sanctioned extermination. And you have the Hans Mill Massacre, where three white young boys are killed, right, cowering in the blacksmith shop. And one Missouri militiaman says, "Nits make lice. If he would have lived, he would have become a Mormon." And I grew up hearing that story because one of those young boys was my ancestor. And then I became a historian, and the only other situation I ever heard that phrase was in massacres against Native Americans.
Yeah.
You kill young Native Americans because if they grow up, they're going to become an Indian,
mm-hmm.
right? emit snake lice was the phrase. So they're using, again, a racialized phrase to justify killing Mormons at the Hans Mill Massacre. Yeah. So, you know, it does provide a bit of different context if you include not just discriminated against religiously, but how do you justify that discrimination? Well, you suggest that they're racially different, and therefore I'm justified in doing this. Yeah.
Wow. So how does all of this new negativity from state and even federal legislation, how does all that affect the church's stance on race, kind of leading up to Brigham Young and Orson Pratt and things like that? So we're still talking about early on in the church, Joseph Smith is still very much the prophet and the leader, and we're talking about them being expelled out of Jackson.
Yeah.
So this is now happening. This is now a new hardship that's happening. What's happening in the church at that point in response to it?
Yeah, so this is when you have, you know, Joseph Smith and other church leaders who are trying to appease, right, and even, you know, go along with enslavement in some sort of way and borrow the same kind of justifications that are being used by Protestant white Americans to justify the enslavement. So they're going to, Joseph Smith and church leaders will issue a proclamation on government in 1835.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And in that, they say that it's not right to interfere between an enslaved person and an enslaver. And Joseph Smith will say, you shouldn't preach to enslaved people without permission from their enslaver. Right. So he's trying to deal with that accusation that Mormons are trying to incite enslaved rebellion. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're not even going to preach to enslaved people unless we have permission from their enslavers, right? So he's trying to suggest and calm the fears, right, in that statement. But, you know, he doesn't claim it as revelation. It's still included in the Doctrine and Covenants. And then in 1836, he will issue a statement that basically just goes along with the curse of Canaan. Right. And curse of Ham, basically. Right. Like, it's the most overtly stretched bunch of scriptures.
Yes, it is.
Used to justify enslavement for over 1,000 years. Right. From, you know, a variety of different groups are using those scriptures in that way. And Joseph Smith in 1836 will go along with that justification. So that's the initial response to what's going on in Missouri. I think it's politically expedient, right, for him. But obviously, you know, historians trace change over time. By the time he dies, he's in a very different place. He's advocating for government-funded gradual emancipation, but gradual, much more accelerated than other gradual emancipation that's playing out across the nation. He's saying, you know, within 6 years, we can do this. We can sell Western land to fund emancipation and reduce the pay of people in Congress, which
went over.
Are willing to give up their pay for this plan, right?
They couldn't veto that fast enough, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, okay, so Joseph is now, it seems, trying to play along to get along. And not that that's necessarily something that generates from him, but this is all brand new. And he's in charge, basically, of the flock, so to speak. He's that pastor. He's that shepherd. And he's trying to keep it together before he loses it. And so there are some things that he bends on or completely gives into just for the sake of peace, we'll say.
Yeah.
And that's where we are right now. And like you said, when he passed away, he was in a very much different place,
yeah,
advocating for emancipation and things of that nature. So he passes. And then subsequently, we have Brigham Young, who is now the new president of the church, new prophet of the church. And this is where we get into, from the outside looking in, the non-historian folks who say, this all started with Brigham Young.
Mm-hmm.
Brigham Young is the one that did this. That's where the restrictions came. That's where the ban came. It's Brigham Young Brigham Young, Brigham Young. That name was seared into my head as like, if it wasn't from him, it's during his dispensation of how we got here.
Yeah.
You know, his time as the president. So can you just kind of, I guess, go a little deeper, I guess, into the justifications that were put forth by Brigham Young and I guess we'll call it an administration for just this conversation. But during his time as president, what were the justifications that were put forth for these restrictions or for ban altogether from certain activities in the church?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is heavy history, and this is you know, the difficult part. I think it's important. Even we'll start with Brigham Young. Let's say March of 1847. So this is 3 years after Joseph Smith has passed away. Mm-hmm. Okay, and Brigham Young is on record with the open racial vision. So change over time for Joseph Smith is, you know, changing in response to political circumstances in Missouri. But by the time he's in Illinois and he's murdered, right, he's advocating, you know, black people are equal to white people in every sort of way. And he's advocating for emancipation, right? Any sort of notion of deficiency, he says, is circumstantial. Right. There is no racial inferiority in Joseph Smith's mind by the end. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see Brigham Young moving in a different direction. OK, mm-hmm. So in March of 1847, he's on record as favorably aware of Key Walker Lewis as a black priesthood holder. Mm-hmm. So this is further evidence, right, of that open priesthood and temple phase. Right. Right? And right. Then we see Brigham Young by the end of 1847 moving in a different direction. So in March of 1847, you have a Black Latter-day Saint named William McCary, who's in winter quarters. Remember, they are leaving the United States and going to northern Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're at winter quarters, and William McCary, you know, approaches Brigham Young and other members of the leadership, and he basically says, I'm experiencing racism in winter quarters, and I think it's true. He was experiencing racism. And,
from the members.
Yeah, from other Latter-day Saints, yes. You know, so there's this protracted interview that takes place between William McCary and Brigham Young, and Brigham Young tries to reassure him. He quotes Acts 17:26, you know, we're all of the same blood, right? Mm-hmm. We're all descended from the same human family. And Brigham, or Joseph Smith, had quoted that in his presidential platform as well, right? This sense that because in the 19th century, there is this polygenesis theory that exists, that black people are so different, there must have been different creations or different genesis stories, right? A different species. Yeah. So you have Brigham Young and Joseph Smith both, that's their pushback against the polygenesis theory, right? It's no, Acts 17:26, we're all of the same blood. And McCary says, but I don't have any positions of authority in the church. And Brigham Young responds by saying, look, we don't even discriminate in distributing priesthood authority. We have one of the best elders, an African, in Lowell, a barber. All of those things match exactly what we know about Key Walker Lewis. Mm-hmm. Key Walker Lewis is in the Lowell, Massachusetts branch. He is a barber by trade, and he is ordained to the priesthood. He hosts missionaries in his home. He's a prominent tithe payer. I found his tithing records. Wow. He's contributed. He's also a musician, so he pays a trombone as tithing at one point. Yeah.
Wow.
But
three concerts.
But he's hosting missionaries in his home. He's also a black abolitionist as well. And Brigham Young is aware of him, right, and cites him as evidence that, you know, we don't discriminate in distributing priesthood authority. We have one of the best elders in African, right? Mm-hmm. So he's on record as favorably aware of a black priesthood holder in March of 1847. The transition will take place by the end of 1847. So William McCary, Brigham Young leads the Vanguard group of Saints into the Salt Lake Valley, and then he'll return to winter quarters. In the meantime, William McCary starts his own schismatic church by having himself, he uses the word sealed to white women in a sexualized ceremony. When this comes to light, he's excommunicated and all of his followers are excommunicated. So we have race mixing taking place, right? But the other issue is that as Brigham Young has gone into the Great Basin, he's appointed a man by the name of William Appleby to survey the conditions of the branches of the church on the East Coast. And Appleby, by his own account, travels 2,000 miles that summer, going from branch to branch. You know, if we get a new gathering place, are you guys ready to gather? What are the conditions, you know? And he goes to the Little Massachusetts branch. And guess who he meets? Yeah, Q. Walker Lewis. But he also meets Q. Walker Lewis's son, Enoch, who's a baptized Black Latter-day Saint. And he is married to Mary Matilda Webster, who is a white Latter-day Saint, and they have a child together. And so William Appleby is disgusted by this race mixing in the Little Massachusetts branch. And he sits down and writes a letter to Brigham Young in June of 1847. You know, Brigham Young's like on his way to the Great Basin. I don't know if he ever gets the letter, but we have the letter. And he basically says, do we allow this in this church? Do we allow Black priesthood ordination? But more importantly, do we allow amalgamation, which is the pre-Civil War term for race mixing? Miscegenation, that term miscegenation hasn't been invented yet. It's invented to denigrate Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation. It's called by his enemies the Miscegenation Proclamation. If you want to free Black people, what you really want is to facilitate race mixing. They'll be freed and then they'll mix with white people and they'll denigrate the white race and democracy's over, right? Those are the terms. So Appleby is using the term amalgamation, and he says, do we allow amalgamation? Those are his two questions for Brigham Young. He said, because if we do, I've yet got to learn it. And then we have his journal entry where he expresses his real feelings. And, you know, Appleby is a racist. In his journal entry, he says, oh, woman, where is your shame? Marrying a Black man and having a child with him. I've never been so disgusted in all my life, he says, and these are members of my church, right? So guess who gets to give Brigham Young his, you know, report in person in December of 1847? It's William Appleby. Yeah, William Appleby. So that meeting goes on for over 4 hours. We have 13 handwritten lines that survive. That's all we know about that meeting, right? Just the 13 handwritten lines, and they're drenched with concern over race mixing. So Brigham Young has learned about what William McCary did while he's gone, right? And Enoch Lewis's marriage to Mary Matilda Webster in the Little Massachusetts branch. And for the first time, he advocates capital punishment as the penalty for race mixing.
That's where that quote comes from. Yeah. Is that from where that everyone pulls that from?
Yeah. Wow. Later.
Brigham Young that did that?
Brigham Young. So he will say in that private meeting, right, the penalty should be death. But later in a public, I think it's 1863, in Utah Territory, he will say the penalty for race mixing should be death on the spot. So he's, that's extreme even in the 19th century context, right? There are some states that have laws, you know, if a Black man rapes a white woman, the death penalty, right? But we're not talking about rape. We're talking about marriage, right? So it's an extreme position. He says it in that private meeting, but he returns to it in a more public venue and, you know, later in the 19th century. So we see him moving in a different direction. Right? Yeah. So that's the point I'm trying to make. And I think race mixing is the reason.
Potentially was also the brother that was in winter quarters who was doing that kind of like added on to it, like, man, we can't trust Black men with the priesthood because they abuse it or priestcraft or something like that. Or
so if you don't give Black men the priesthood, you don't have to worry about interracial ceilings. You don't have to worry about race mixing in temples.
Mm.
I think that's what's going on.
Gotcha.
So he doesn't first openly articulate a racial priesthood restriction. So in those 13 handwritten lines that survive, priesthood is not mentioned.
Okay.
So, you know, some people suggest, oh, maybe the racial restrictions begin in 1847. I don't, if they talk about it, right, that meeting goes on for like 4 hours.
Right? Yeah.
It's just not in the written record.
Mm-hmm.
But I do see him transitioning, right, from where he was in March to where he is in December as a transition. But he's not talking about priesthood yet, at least. He's not first openly articulating a priesthood restriction until January and February of 1852, publicly articulating it, right? And that's to the Utah Territorial Legislature.
Wow. So here we are, and we have these two experiences that now have Brigham Young going in the opposite trajectory, like you're mentioning, of President or Joseph Smith. So was there any pushback, I guess, from any leadership in the church as this starts to go in the other direction when it comes to restrictions and things like that? Was there any pushback from any other leadership?
Yeah, so we have in 1849, Lorenzo Snow, he was asking a question, and more than likely, you know, the leadership, at least Brigham Young, has solidified around a racial restriction by 1849, but it's once again a private meeting, and so how widely known is that? And I can't find any evidence that, you know, people are aware of it. But it seems that Brigham Young has probably concluded around a racial restriction. And Lorenzo Snow is basically saying, you know, what about the condition of Black people? Can we open the door for them? That's kind of his question. But the minutes for that meeting are just a couple of lines, right? And so I wish we had more context for that conversation. The real pushback is Orson Pratt.
Okay. Yeah.
So Orson Pratt is also a member of the territorial legislature. And so we have really a profound debate that takes place in 1852 between Orson Pratt and Brigham Young. And they are debating a couple of laws that are being considered in that legislative session. So it's an all Latter-day Saint territorial legislature. And you have to understand that religion and politics are mixed
completely.
You know, completely. And Brigham Young defends that, right? Like, he's like, I have every right to come here and dictate to elders in Israel who are also legislators, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, he says the federal government should stay out of our business. I can do this because we're all elders in Israel. He gives a fiery speech defending the right to mix church and state in that 1852 legislative session.
Mm-hmm.
But you have Brigham Young then, who is president of the church and governor of Utah Territory. And you have Orson Pratt, who is an LDS apostle and territorial legislator.
Mm-hmm.
Wants to reorganize the first presidency in 1847. So remember, he governs for 3 years as just the president of the Quorum of the Twelve.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, we need to reorganize the first presidency after 3 years, and Orson Pratt objects. They're butting heads again in this legislative session. So you have white enslavers who have brought their Black enslaved to Utah Territory, some of whom are baptized Latter-day Saints. So white Latter-day Saints enslaving their fellow Latter-day Saints. You know, all of this works in the South because laws are already in place. But in a new territory, there are no laws in place to govern these relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So the territorial legislature is debating what should be the, you know, legal code around white enslavers and their Black enslaved in Utah Territory. And Orson Pratt suggested that bill should be rejected in its entirety. We should not sanction slavery in Utah Territory.
Right.
And he will also propose for the election bill that Black men be allowed to vote in Utah Territory.
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
That's big.
That's
huge.
So it is. I mean, he's ahead of the rest of the nation on this count. Right, suggesting that Utah Territory, as it writes its election law, should allow Black men to vote. And this will bring produce some of Brigham Young's most racist statements in response to Orson Pratt's proposal. But Brigham Young will give, you know, a couple of speeches in this legislative session. So the question animating the nation at the time is, can human beings be held as property? And Northerners say, no, that violates the, you know, Declaration of Independence and founding principles of the nation. And Southerners say, no, actually the Constitution protects property rights. And that is the question that leads us into civil war. We can't, as a nation, solve that question. Mm-hmm. And Utah Territory is attempting to address it. Brigham Young would say, yeah, human beings shouldn't be held as property. So the law that they actually pass elevates the enslaved above the condition of mere property because it grants them some rights. Mm-hmm. It's not satisfying, right? But in 19th century context, it grants them some rights, but it does not free anyone then enslaved. So if you have some rights, you are not mere property,
right,
as under chattel slavery in southern states. Mm-hmm. It requires that Black people be educated. In southern slave codes, you legally can't.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right? And it says that you can't be sold to another enslaver without giving your consent to a probate judge outside of your enslavers being present, right? And you can't be taken from Utah Territory against your will. In other words, taken back into the South and sold into chattel slavery, right? So there are some rights that are granted that wouldn't have been available otherwise, but it frees no one then enslaved. So if you come to Utah Territory as an enslaved person, you would die as an enslaved person. But we think that because of Orson Pratt's strong objection, they removed 18 lines from the original draft of the bill that would have passed the condition of servitude on to the next generation. But they take those 18 words out, and as a result, I believe we, me and my co-authors in a book that is coming out in October, we believe it turns it into a conservative form of gradual emancipation, meaning that the condition of servitude wouldn't have passed to the next generation.
Mm-hmm. So you can't be born into
slavery.
Into slavery.
Correct.
Right.
But you can die as an enslaved person, but if you have children, they're not going to inherit your condition because of Orson Pratt's objections.
That's major.
Yeah, so they pull those 18 words out that would have passed the condition of servitude to the next generation. Right? And we think it's in response to Orson Pratt's really strident anti-slavery speech. Orson Pratt, so Brigham Young in the legislative session will define Black people as cursed descendants of Cain. And this will be his only justification for a racial restriction, priesthood restriction. He says, Cain murders his brother Abel because Cain murders Abel. All of Cain's descendants, who he supposes to be Black people, and this is, you know, predates the founding of the LDS faith by hundreds of years, right? That idea, right? An interpretation of Genesis, once again, presumes to be Black people. He says all of Abel's descendants, who presumes to be white people, will have to get the priesthood before any of Cain's descendants. Mm. Because Cain's murder of Abel brings a curse upon his descendants.
Revelation just goes out the window. I'm like, what happened? What have you been praying about these things? He's a prophet.
Right.
Sheesh.
And it's a violation of the second article of faith, is the other part of this, right?
Right.
Joseph Smith says, we're held accountable for our own sins, not for Adam's transgression. And Brigham Young is holding the supposed descendants of Cain accountable for a murder in which they took them part. Mm-hmm. And Orson Pratt, in his anti-slavery speech, defines Black people as innocent. So Brigham Young, inherently guilty, right? They inherit the curse of Cain in his estimation. And in Orson Pratt, he says, Africans are innocent. So you have those two positions being articulated, right? And he also says curses are not multi-generational. Whatever happened in the Old Testament, right, that was specific to that time and place, and it doesn't pass down. So even if you want to claim that that's true in the Old Testament time, it has no relevance to 1852 Utah Territory. That's his position that he takes.
Right.